Welcome to the Time We Have podcast, presented to you by Motor Neuron Disease, New South Wales. MND New South Wales acknowledges the traditional custodians of the land we live on. We pay our respects to all elders, past and present, of all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander nations.
What's rewarding is I absolutely love making a difference in my clients' lives, no matter how big or small.
Hello and a very warm welcome to the MND New South Wales podcast, The Time We Have. My name is Sabine Krajewski and I work for MND New South Wales. Every few weeks, I speak with someone who is in some way connected to motor neuron disease. And my guest today is Manasi Thornley. Manasi has been looking after people living with MND for 20 years now. She grew up near Mumbai and she came to Australia to study occupational therapy and what led to her career path and how she became the passionate and empathetic OT she is now is a fascinating story she's going to share with us today, or so I hope. Welcome, Manasi.
Thank you, Sabine. It's a great pleasure and an honor to be here today.
I just said that you grew up near Mumbai, and I know that you're not really fond of your birthplace at all. Why is that?
I would put it as the weather that, brings, it's like tropical weather, but it's very hot, it's very humid. I'm the kind of person that would blossom in the Canadian Alps, if you ask me. So this crisp weather we are having in Sydney at the moment is right up my alley. So that's why I think the main reason would be the weather. The second reason would be I feel like I've got some sensory issues. So lots of people around me, lots of distractions overwhelms me. I feel that just taking the train into college, like they call it, year 11 and 12 in Mumbai, was quite hectic and traumatizing for me. I love my birth country, don't take me wrong, but I definitely know that I wouldn't be living there.
Okay, right. So you came for the weather. Lots of people do come for the weather to Australia, but then of course we discovered that there are lots of other beautiful things here as well.
Absolutely.
When you grew up in India, what were your dreams? What did you think you would want to be later?
Sure. So growing up in school, education in India is very, very valued and encouraged. And there is no, things might have changed now, but there back then when I was growing up, there was no possibility of, dropping out of, say, school early, or the expectation was for you to attend university. Mm-hmm. And my teachers were an absolute role model for me. I really wanted to, become one of them. I wanted to influence children, wanted to teach and make a difference in a young life's life. So growing up, I really wanted to become a teacher. But I clearly didn't become one. But I do that in different ways now.
So somehow if you have a calling, it'll find you. Yeah, when we spoke before, Manasi, you told me about your reason to become an OT. And that's a really, really fascinating but also scary story. Would you be able to share that with us?
Absolutely. It actually is very raw in my mind and heart even now. So when I was 15, I had just finished my year 10 exams and I had, put on a little bit of weight to a 15-year-old. That's quite a big thing as body image back then. And I said to my mom, I'm going to go for a run. And when I come back, I can then, concentrate on other things. So I did. I went for a run. Back then, I used to live in a third level unit with no lifts, so I had to walk up the stairs to get there. Got upstairs, was feeling really fatigued, and I said to my mum, I'm just going to go and have a lie down. When I woke up the next morning, I actually couldn't move at all. So I thought I was in a horrific nightmare. Mm-hmm. I started to cry, started to yell, scream out for help. They immediately took me to the local hospital. After running some tests, I was diagnosed with Guillain-Barré syndrome. I was paralyzed down for approximately, I would say, 3.5 months. And it basically, because my respiratory function wasn't affected, I didn't have to stay in hospital. I could come home, which I was grateful about because I don't think my family would have been able to afford my medical bills back then. The system works very differently in India. And as I was going through those 3.5 months of progress or little to no progress sometimes, because it felt like a very long time when you were kind of stuck not being able to do anything as a 15-year-old. Yeah. My brother, who was a little bit 2 years older than me and stronger, was, you know, lifting me and taking me to the toilet. And my mother was showering me and dressing me. And my dad was feeding me. So I came to this conclusion that there has to be some profession that looks at the activities that we take for granted every day in our life and somehow makes a difference to people who are suffering like I am, whether it be a short-term disability or a chronic long-term disability, and then work out whether there is, you know, whether we can provide some alternative methods of doing things that we again take for granted, or whether there are, you know, looking at adaptive aids, for example. And so when I started to look at, because I was in year 10 anyway, I knew I had to kind of take on those subjects if I, that's what I wanted to do. So when I started looking at those things, occupational therapy was the perfect fit to I personally gone through. And that's how I decided to become an OT, and 22 years later, here I am.
That's I mean, it sort of gives me goosebumps to just listen to, even though I'm listening to it for the second time. Did you, during that time, know that you would fully recover, or did you, were you also in fear that maybe you would not?
Yeah, so initially, obviously, that fear sets in and you don't really know what's wrong with you, but with tests and with consultation from the doctors, because I was young as well, I think the prevalence of recovery is quite high. Young people with that GBS, so I was hopeful. I never gave up hope, and I still remember having lots of tears when my big toe started to move. That was my first indication that my muscle activity and my movement and my function was coming back. And honestly, I think, you know, we did a lot of things that we could at home from a rehab perspective. And looking back, I hope that I had received formal professional input from from the allied health team, because they would have been absolutely invaluable for that. But unfortunately, we didn't have that opportunity back then. So my mum and my dad did daily massages to try and get that circulation and blood flow going. I tried to do as much as I could in terms of once I started getting my activity, my function back. So it seems like we kind of, I rehabbed myself at the time.
Yeah. Has that changed? If that happens nowadays in India, would that be a better position to be in?
Absolutely. I definitely believe a lot of recognition in terms of allied health professionals.
Right. Yeah.
And there are a lot of clinics that are popping up that have allied health input. So I absolutely believe that things would have been different.
Okay. So if I summarize, your occupational therapist helps people with everyday tasks, right? Could be anything. So you mentioned eating or getting dressed or getting showered or anything like that. And usually they help people who had an accident or had a stroke. And we are talking about people living with MND today. So what can an OT do to support, in particular, people living with MND?
Yeah, sure. So look, with people with MND, we as occupational therapists, we see them at the different stages of their progression within their disease progression. So I like to see it as I try and keep my patients or clients as safe and as independent as possible within their environment. So, for example, at the start, if they're still working and if they're having some difficulty with minor tasks within the home or at their work, we would look into that to start off with. So I would be guided depending on their disease progression and also their function at the time. So I would support my clients from start to finish through their disease progression, looking at minor tasks to start off with, then looking at some equipment to keep them safe and independent, and then maybe also looking at adapting tasks as well. As occupational therapists, we do a lot of task analysis, and sometimes to us we think, oh, maybe that's common sense, but common sense is not very common. And I think that's why occupational therapy is so good in that sense, that we kind of go look at it from a different angle or a different glasses and go, could you try this task this way? Would that help? If that doesn't work, could we try using this adaptive technique or adaptive equipment? Would that help? So in overall arching, quality of life means everything for an occupational therapist. And so we want to make sure that our people living with MND have that quality of life, no matter how short or how long their life is with the disease.
So safety is one of the main issues there for you as well, right? To keep people safe while they're doing things as much as they can on their own.
Absolutely. We don't want our people living with MND coming into hospital settings following a fall of fracture or following a skin breakdown. So we we keep them as safe as possible. Yeah.
Can you give an example of what minor changes could be and what a solution can be? Probably there's no one fits all. So when you talk about there has to be, or you're thinking about different approaches, so it also depends on the person.
Yeah, absolutely. I can give you a very recent example, actually. I've got a client who's having a lot of difficulty feeding themselves, and they like to socialize, you know, with their friends and family. So they're starting to get embarrassed about going out to eat meals in public in a restaurant because, you know, they're having difficulty bringing the food to them out, for example. So we're looking at different techniques. So whether they can take their own cutlery with them, whether it's adapted with a foam grip or whether it's actually adapted with an angle, you know, change in the cutlery, for example, making sure that they've got like a raised table if they want to take that little portable table with them, so that even if the tables that they sit at is not height adjustable, you know, giving them techniques to bring their body forward to then bring the food towards their mouth. So again, the way I have worked out what would work for that particular client would be to actually see them perform that activity, task analyze that activity from the time they grab the spoon, for example, till they dip it into their food that they're going for, and then bringing it to the mouth and then making those sound recommendations. Because at the end of the day, I don't want this client to stop doing what they love. I would want to adapt their environment slightly to make sure that they're still able to enjoy that activity with their friends and family.
Okay. And you would probably have to tend to different needs over time as well, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. You know, it depends on how far that they can take those recommendations. If things deteriorate a little bit further in that example, I would then look at different other options. Absolutely.
Yeah. Sure. Okay. And I heard that some people with motor neuron disease have more than one OT. What would be the reason for that? I mean, if you have one,
Of course. Look, I think with NDIS, we've gotten a lot of change in our system in terms of choice and control. And so some of our clients are shopping for different allied health professionals, including OT. And you might find that someone specializes, say, in home modifications, or someone specializes in communication and assistive technology, for example, or in sleeping. So what our clients are now able to do is they are able to gain that choice and control and choose the therapist, just like private health insurance, choose their therapist of who they feel more comfortable with or who they think have the expertise. From my perspective, there's nothing wrong with that. My only suggestion to people listening today would be to make sure that you know what you want and what is feasible versus what the therapist can offer. At the end of the day, we want to make sure that our clients or people living with motor neuron disease get the best care possible. And we want to also make sure that our profession is able to provide that to them as well.
So we always talk about the importance of a multidisciplinary team. So that's why I was really surprised when I heard that some people have several OTs, because if you multiply all the other allied health as well, you'd have a huge team around people. But in general, if you have a multidisciplinary team, so what allied health colleagues are you closely working with as an OT?
Sure. Now, to answer your first comment, yes, they might have multiple OTs, but those OTs might not be able to work closely with other multidisciplinary teams, depending on what sector they're coming from and depending on their access to different multidisciplinary teams. I am very, very grateful that I work with a very strong multidisciplinary team. And the benefits of having a big multidisciplinary team is that our only goal is our client or our person living with EMI. And then our second goal is to ensure that we liaise very closely together and we communicate the client's needs, and then we work out who is doing what. So to give you an example, if someone approaches me, I'm doing a home visit, for example, and if someone approaches me, or look, I'm having difficulty with my BiPAP mask, you know, it's not sealing properly, for example, can you help me? I wouldn't dwell into that as an OT per se, because I haven't experienced that and don't really have the expertise. But I already know that I've got a respiratory physio that I can consult with and make sure that the client is seen in a timely manner. So the multidisciplinary team is very, very valuable, especially for our people working with motor neuron disease, because as we all know, their progression can change significantly, whether it be from a week-to-week basis or a month-to-month basis. And it's really important. We have case conferences once a month, really important to discuss our clients with each case conference to make sure everyone is at the same page in the delivery of care that we provide to our clients.
Right. So you said you already mentioned you are doing home visits and you know each client and visit them and talk things through with them. But you also work in a hospital setting, right?
Yeah.
If you think about your job on the whole, what do you find challenging when working in particular regarding people living with MND, and what rewarding? Maybe if you can start with the challenges. So what do you find?
I would say with the challenges would be the disease progression in general. You have to be on top of your recommendations. If you're, you know, providing assistive technology recommendation, for example, you need to be on top of where are you going to get funding from. Not all of our people living with MND, as you know, are NDIS eligible. That brings a lot more challenges in terms of where are we going to get that equipment from. FlexEquip is an absolute godsend to our people with motor neuron disease. So people listening today, if you haven't heard of FlexEquip, please, please look it up online. They are fabulous. And from an OT perspective, they are our first go-to in terms of what's available and what's not available. So that would be our biggest challenge in terms of progression.
And you'd find that information on the MND New South Wales website about FlexEquip.
Absolutely. And I would also urge health professionals who are listening today to also look at the website, because it's not just for people living with MND. It's also for people who are recommending these assistive technology equipment. The second challenge, I would say, is resources. So, you know, unfortunately, in Australia, we are very bound with funding under 65 and over 65 funding. People living with motor neuron disease have the same need for funding. However, if they're over 65, they're very limited to what we can get. So it actually really, really hurts my soul, if I can say that, for someone who I know needs a robotic feeder, for example, to really remain independent. However, they're over 65 and I'm really, really stuck in terms of where I'm going to get funding for that. However, clients under 65 can get that. So those are my biggest challenges. What's rewarding is I absolutely love making a difference in my clients' lives, no matter how big or small. Mm-hmm. I love that I can make a recommendation, they try it, and they come back to me and say, oh my God, Manasi, this has really saved me 2 hours of my day, for example.
Right.
Or, oh my God, I've got so much more energy now. I can really get out and about in my power wheelchair, for example, and socialize. So I hope that I make a difference in my clients' lives and improve their quality of life. And that's what's rewarding Right. from an everyday job.
Yeah, absolutely. And a small thing can make a big difference here as well. Like,
absolutely. Oh. Absolutely.
There's also, of course, an emotional side to looking after people with motor neuron disease. And you told me before that you sometimes cry with your patient. What kind of situations are those?
Yeah, sure. So like I said before, I follow my patients or people's journey right from the start of this disease progression to the end. And there are times when you know that you're saying your final goodbye to your patient, and the family are around, and at the end of the day, we are all humans. We do what we can. We get attached to our clients. I'm getting teary now just talking about it. You know, you get attached to your clients, and you want to hold their hand, and you're gonna say to them everything's gonna be okay. You know, we've reached this far together. I hope that, you know, things have, yes, you don't want this. Yes, you've been given a real sad card in life, but you were there for them right till the end. And that's what I mean by I feel comfortable, saying goodbye to my clients. It's been difficult. Yeah. It's taken a long time to reach that stage where you need to know when to let go as well. It's actually quite emotionally also rewarding that you're able to be part of their lives.
Right. Yeah, definitely. But it takes a bit of stamina and a bit of also looking after yourself, a bit of self-care, I suppose.
So, absolutely.
And I mean, I think what you need in any medical field, allied health or any doctor, anyone who's helping any carer is empathy, right? You need to have somebody who is able to see things from the patient's perspective and to put themselves in their shoes. So if you do that, of course, you also have that downside that you are emotionally challenged sometimes to keep that up and absolutely. Keep that going over many years. So, yeah.
Absolutely. And you know, at the end of the day, I always ask myself, if this was my mom that was being treated, or if this was my grandfather, or if this was my, you know, child, how would I want them to be treated? And that's how I would love to treat my patients living with motor neuron disease, with that empathy, with that ability to, you know, have that listening ear. If you can't do anything about it, be honest about that and, you know, maybe forward their query or their frustration on to people that can help.
Yeah.
Be that sounding board. And as occupational therapists, because we are in their environment so much more than any other allied health profession, I tend to start case managing these people living with MND and the carers, because they're the first ones to kind of say to you, this is not working. I'm really upset about this, or whatever it be. So if you can't help them yourself, please guide them in the right direction.
I think it's amazing that you've come to the point where you are also comfortable with your own grief or with your own, you know, loss that you experience, and that's fine. And you can live that together with your patients. And that's maybe something for people who begin and feel like they could just sort of say it's something you learn over time, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you need to be open about it, because we're not robots. If we didn't have feelings, we would be robots, but we are humans. And In the last 20 years of working with people with motor neuron disease, have had my fair share of cry, and it is okay to do that. I would say that, you know, obviously, within reason, you know, your carers that are also caring for these people with motor neuron disease are also then comfortable to open their feelings as well, because you are there.
Very important. But back to the question of how you look after yourself and how you find your balance, because that's one side. But of course, over time, that could also lead to a burnout. So how do you protect yourself from that? And how do you find the right balance and look after your own well-being and your own mental health?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, I have always been a believer to keep work at work. I'm very lucky to be able to do that in the line of work I'm in. So when my shift, I call it, finishes, I walk out the door and I leave my work worries behind me. I've always had that rule. So you'll be surprised. I don't talk about my work to my family at all. My family might not even know how many motor neuron disease clients I have at the moment, for example. So I leave work at work. That's number one. And number two is I do dance fitness. So that's what makes me happy. I love doing it's this thing called Jungle Body. And it's like Zumba, but it's a slower version, which works.
I'm impressed. Okay. But
I actually do that 3 times to 4 times a week. And I know that's really, really hard for some listeners listening to, you know, move away from family to then go and do this extra something. But even if you start doing it once a week and, you know, find what makes you smile. So with Jungle Body, I'm smiling a lot when I'm bouncing around, you know, exercising, because I love the music that we do the exercise to. So simple things like that. So I absolutely believe that, you know, self-care is the most important, because if you're not in it, with the attitude that you not want to be in it, your people with MND are not going to react to you the way that they would want to. They won't trust you. You know, they won't open up to you, because you're going to have a flat affect, right? So absolutely, we need to make sure that, you know, we look after ourselves. I always have a smile on my face, even if I'm in pain.
You do. Actually, every time I see you, you do. I'm like, probably just done jungle dance or something. Oh, my God. That's a common thing that people say, they don't have time for exercise. But actually, in the end, it gives you more time, because it also relaxes you and does something good for your mood and for your overall
absolutely life. Look, I say to myself, in my 20s, I gave all to my career, because you'd finish uni, you had a tech stack. In your 30s, you were busy having children and running around after them. 40s is my decade, people, because, you know, I'm giving it all. I'm being selfish. I'm doing what I like. I'm trying to be healthy. I'm trying to, you know, this decade is a selfish decade for me.
Okay, cool. You're married with 2 children. Do they sort of support what you do? And are they on the same trip and think, yes, mom's now in her decade of selfishness?
My husband's really supportive. And my kids are very self-sufficient, can I say. So I've got a 13-year-old daughter and a 10-year-old son. And look, they take themselves to school and back in a bus. When they come back, they'll, you know, make themselves meals, and they're quite self-sufficient. I have to do a lot of cleaning when I get home from work, because things are you know what I mean. My husband works from home with COVID, so he's really supportive, in the sense that, you know, I get home, I do what I need to do, and I'm out of there for my Jungle Body session. So that's 4 times a week. So we're very, I am very, very lucky that I have a supportive unit to support me, support my clients. But because both of us work in different sectors altogether, the pressures are very different. So the pressures for me are very emotional and, empathy driven, whereas the pressures project is an IT, very project driven. So it's they're different, but we recognize that and we kind of support each other in that. My daughter actually wants to become a paramedic, she's told me. So we'll see where takes her. So I think overall as a family we've grown, and overall as an OP I have grown as well.
Yeah, it sounds good. There was one question I wanted to ask you about. If you think back to studying for your degree, and if you think about people who study the same and have the same dreams and want to, you know, become successful OTs in the future, what would you add to prepare future allied health for working with seriously ill people, like people living with MND? What's missing in the program, or what could you tell them or give them as advice for their futures?
Yeah, look, back in uni, I'm talking 22 years back here, so I'm really, really
my
memory. absolutely. I believe that we do a lot of basic OT stuff, a lot of hands-on training. I believe we had one neurological unit through university, but I honestly only learned about motor neuron disease when I started work as a health professional, as an OT. And my first patient, I still remember my first patient and going through that overwhelming feeling about, oh my God, I want to do so much for this client, but I actually don't know where to start feeling.
Right, yeah.
So I absolutely agree that universities need to prepare future allied health professionals.
Yeah.
Especially for those neurodegenerative kind of types of diseases, in terms of, you know, whether it be in-house theory training, but also combine that with simulation training in terms of, you know, practical stuff of what you would do, would absolutely help people living with MND.
Mm.
And I also believe that, you know, 22 years on, now we've got quite a bit of, you know, understanding of what motor neuron disease is, the different phenotypes can and can't do for people living with MND. So I absolutely believe that the universities need to also pick that up in their curriculum.
Yeah.
Because at the end of the day, it's going to help everyone.
We actually have connections to a couple of universities, and we have advisors going and give a guest lecture about motor neuron disease, and that we're very welcome there. They're happy to, you know, see someone from MND New South Wales and talk about it. So at least students have heard about it before they go, and they know where to go. They can go to MND New South Wales to get more information and get help there. Mm, yeah.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great start.
Last but not least, the topic of this MND podcast is time, as you know, the time we have. What do you do with the time you have, and what is important for you to spend time on?
Look, I give it my all when I'm at work. I'm a can-do person. Sometimes people need to tell me how to say no. So the time that I do have at work, I give it my all, and I would hopefully have my clients vouch on that. In the time at home, I like to spend time with my two beagles. They're very, very naughty. They keep me on my toes. They are on tables trying to steal food, digging holes and, you know, chasing people around. So I do like to spend time with my puppies. They keep me calm. They keep me connected. And I do like to spend time with my family as well. I love to travel. I'm hoping to see most of the world before my hips give way as well. So I would love to continue to do that. And that's the time that I love. Yeah.
Sounds like a good plan. Manasi, thank you so much for talking to me this morning. It was a pleasure.
No trouble at all. It's such an honor and such a privilege. And shout out to MND New South Wales. You guys are a great mob, and continue all your great work.
Yay. Thank you.
Thank you.
MND New South Wales is funded largely by the generosity of community members, with only around 10 to 15% being received from government funding. If you'd like to donate, please go to www.mndnsw.org.au/donate or give MND New South Wales a call, and one of our friendly staff will assist you. Check out our website for more information at www.mndnsw.org.au or call the MND New South Wales info line on 1800 777 175.